Hey everyone, so I meant to get this one out about a week ago, man. Anyway, so Joe Rogan again. In the last episode, I responded to some clips of Joe and Aaron Rodgers talking about religion. This time I'm going to be responding or reacting to a couple of clips from Joe's recent interview, or relatively recent interview, with comedian Cat Williams. I remember the last time I was kind of complaining about Joe focusing more on political or social issues recently, the whole anti-woke thing, and, you know, wishing he'd get back to talking about the more weird or fringe stuff. Well, as they say, be careful what you wish for, because the Cat Williams appearance was absolutely wild. It might be one of the most out there Rogan interviews yet. They pretty much, you know, checked all the boxes, lost civilization, aliens, the Anunnaki, whether or not the moon is real, the occult, etc., etc. And as you regular listeners will know, I'm a skeptic, but I nevertheless love these kinds of far-out topics. I have an interest in the history of the occult and just weird history in general. I've even done a couple of documentary episodes on the 19th century French occultist Eliphas Levi's Baphomet symbol. And that's actually how I found out about Cat Williams' appearance on Rogan. I get a notification every time someone leaves a comment on one of my YouTube videos, and I started getting comments on, I think it was my first Baphomet episode or documentary, from people who were saying that they had just come from watching Cat Williams' appearance on Rogan's podcast. And my general impression of Cat Williams from his Rogan appearance is that he's a very smart, well-read guy, but I don't necessarily agree with all of his conclusions. He'll prove himself knowledgeable about a particular topic, and yet some of his facts or claims might seem a bit off. And speaking of his being well-read, he claims to have read 3,000 books a year while he was growing up. I'm not even sure if that's possible. I'm not sure how the math works out, but that's his claim. Either way, he is pretty knowledgeable, and as someone interested in things like history, the occult, alchemy, I was really impressed by some of the topics he was aware of. He brought up Hermes Trismegistus and the Emerald Tablet, which I mentioned briefly in my second Baphomet episode, I think. And he even brought up the idea of the homunculus, is it homunculi, plural, which is like an artificial being brought to life by alchemy or magic. And the example was pretty funny. He was talking about Smurfette being a homunculus, since she doesn't have parents, she was brought to life by Gargamel, if you're old enough to remember the old Smurfs cartoon. And I probably don't have to do this. Well, I probably don't have to do anything. But I thought it was kind of funny. This is from Wikipedia. Gargamel wants to take revenge against the Smurfs for his humiliating defeat at their hands. He decides that the most horrible plan to destroy them would be to send them a female Smurf who would seduce them and lead them to their doom. He thus fashions her out of clay and dips her in potion, creating Smurfette. So yeah, she's essentially a homunculus. Gotta hand that one to Cat Williams. He ain't wrong. But as you've probably already guessed, he also brings up Baphomet, and I'll play that clip now.
That's what makes information so powerful is, you know, you don't care how people feel about the ritual. It's about, does following the ritual work? Yeah. And so you can fool yourself into thinking there isn't one, but the evidence will be clear. So like when I was like, all these guys are wearing dresses, and everybody's like, oh, he keeps talking about people wearing dresses. No, it's not.
That is a weird thing.
It's not like that. Look at it from a different way. Look at it. Show me one person that ever wore a dress in Hollywood unsuccessfully. That's how you understand what a ritual is. Mm. So 20 years ago, I knew that transgenders was going to be a thing. It wasn't because I was a prophet. It's just I had gotten so much information that I understood that things are secular. So I understood that the earliest I had seen that word transgender was Baphomet, the transgender. And so I knew that in the ritual of Baphomet, the transgender, to show allegiance to him, you had to kiss his ass ring.
Really?
And it said both of those things. So I knew that both of those things would become popular in the future. And that somehow calling people the goat would be normalized over the sheep being always the most popular reference.
So pretty wild, and Cat Williams isn't the first person I've heard suggesting some possibly nefarious link between Baphomet and transgenderism. There's even this weird phenomenon on YouTube where you have conspiracy theorists obsessed with trying to prove that famous female celebrities are actually men and that there's some sinister agenda behind it, usually linked to the Illuminati, I believe, or something to that effect. And to be fair, I totally get why people, especially Christians, not saying Cat Williams is necessarily a Christian, not sure. I believe he had a strict Jehovah's Witness upbringing, no birthdays, no holidays. He says earlier in the interview that all he was really allowed to do was read, and that's how, as he explains it, he came to know so much about a variety of different topics. But I get why people think Baphomet is a satanic symbol, it's a sinister-looking, hermaphroditic goat creature, and goats, hooves, horns, these are things we've traditionally come to associate with the devil. And I'm sure the fact that modern Satanist groups like the late Anton Zandor LaVey's Church of Satan and the newer Satanic Temple, that they embrace Baphomet as a symbol, probably understandably reinforces this idea that it's a satanic symbol. And as I've mentioned ad nauseum on the show, both the Church of Satan and the Satanic Temple are non-theistic organizations. They don't literally believe in a devil. They more view the devil or Lucifer as a symbol of free thought, rebellion, that kind of thing. But I'll try to offer a brief rundown here. The story behind the Baphomet symbol is that it was created by a 19th century French occultist, as I think I mentioned earlier, by the name of Eliphas Levi. And as far as I know, Levi wasn't a Satanist. And he actually wasn't even Jewish, he adopted a Hebrew name. People often think of occultism as being evil or tantamount to devil worship, but occult just refers to secret or hidden knowledge, and Western occultism is a hodgepodge of different practices, systems, and traditions, Gnosticism, Jewish mysticism, including Kabbalah, Christian Rosicrucianism, Eastern spirituality. But there are aspects that are considered darker than others, such as the supposed summoning and binding of demons, like what's spoken of in the Ars Goetia or Lesser Key of Solomon. And as I've mentioned on the show before, it's thought this goes back, at least in part, to stories of King Solomon using demons or spirits bound to his will in order to build the first temple. But Levi's Baphomet symbol wasn't intended to be a symbol of evil. It was meant to represent balance or a union of opposites, which is why it has a blending of male and female attributes, and the one arm raised pointing upward and the other lowered pointing downward is a reference to the Hermetic maxim, as above, so below, which is a paraphrasing of a passage found on the Emerald Tablet, which, as I mentioned, Cat Williams also references during his Rogan appearance. And on the Baphomet figure's arms are the Latin alchemical terms salve and coagula, to separate and bring together, coagula as in coagulate. And also, according to Levi, the goat head is supposed to represent the bestial nature of man or of the sinner. But on the forehead is an upright pentacle, as opposed to a downward one, a pentagram, which would be considered a representation of evil. And then atop the head is almost what looks like a torch, representing the light or flame of intelligence or knowledge or wisdom. And I'll actually read Levi's own description of his symbol. And I believe I actually read this in both of my Baphomet documentary episodes as well. The goat on the frontispiece carries the sign of the pentagram on the forehead, with one point at the top, a symbol of light. So yeah, as I was mentioning, if it's pointed downward, it's considered an inversion, a symbol of evil. But if it's pointed upward, it's considered good or a symbol of light. His two hands forming the sign of occultism, the one pointing up to the white moon of Hesed, the other pointing down to the black one of Gomorrah, I believe it is. And those are two Hebrew terms, and I believe they're related to Kabbalah in the Tree of Life. The sign expresses the perfect harmony of mercy with justice. His one arm is female, the other male, like the ones of the Androgyne of Kunrath. And that's a reference to something called a rebus, which I believe is also one of the highest goals of alchemy. It also is a kind of considered a union of opposites and is represented by a kind of hermaphroditic figure possessing both male and female traits, the attributes of which we had to unite with those of our goat because he is one and the same symbol. The flame of intelligence shining between his horns is the magic light of the universal balance, the image of the soul elevated above matter. As the flame, whilst being tied to matter, shines above it, the beast's head expresses the horror of the sinner, whose materially acting, solely responsible part has to bear the punishment exclusively. The soul is insensitive according to its nature and can only suffer when it materializes. The rod standing instead of genitals symbolizes eternal life. The body covered with scales, the water. The semicircle above it, the atmosphere. The feathers following above, the volatile. Humanity is represented by the two breasts and the androgyne arms of this sphinx of the occult sciences. But I believe in being as intellectually honest as possible, so it should be mentioned that the look of the figure was partially based on the devil of the medieval tarot. But it gets complicated. The devil of the medieval tarot was also thought to represent the Greek god Mercury to some, which also had alchemical significance. And Levi even includes the god Mercury's caduceus in his Baphomet illustration, which he references when he mentions the figure having a rod instead of genitals. I was going to make a joke about having a rod, but maybe I already did. Anyway, the name Baphomet is a reference to an enigmatic figure or idol that the Knights Templar were accused of worshipping. There's a number of theories regarding what the name means, but one of the more prominent ones is that it's a corruption of the name Muhammad. Another accusation leveled at the Templars is that they had supposedly gone native, so to speak, embracing Saracen customs or beliefs. I go way deeper in my two Baphomet documentaries or episodes. The thing about having to kiss Baphomet's butthole, I could be wrong, but I think Cat Williams may be referring to the supposed black mass that witches and devil worshippers were said to engage in during the Middle Ages. Where supposed participants would have to perform any number of profane acts, including kissing the devil's backside. And the Baphomet symbol, in fairness, is sometimes referred to as the Sabbatic goat. But Levi believed that so-called devil worship that, you know, took place in the Middle Ages were actually just vestiges of old forms of pagan worship, and that the goat involved wasn't the Christian devil, but an older pagan god such as the god or goat of Mendes referenced by Herodotus, which may have been associated with the Greek god Pan. So I'm not trying to suggest that the Baphomet symbol is necessarily wholesome or something you'd want to associate yourself with if you're a Christian, but it wasn't intended to represent the Christian devil either. It's not that simple. At the end of the day, it's a kind of alchemical or occult symbol representing a, you know, balance or a union of opposites. But on a lighter note, was Cat Williams implying that he predicted that not only would transgenderism become in vogue, but also eating ass? Forgive me. Then he also links Baphomet to the modern use of the word goat. That might be a bit of a stretch, but it's funny. I remember when that phrase first became popular, I was like, why are people calling famous people goats like it's a compliment? Then I had my Light Dawns on Marblehead moment. I was like, oh, greatest of all time. Okay. Seriously doubt it has anything to do with Baphomet, though. I just think people like coming up with cute little acronyms or coining new slang terms. But now let's listen to Joe talk about the Mark of the Beast.
I always wonder whether or not all the stories in the Bible, it's just where we are experiencing it. Like the Mark of the Beast thing that we were talking about earlier. If that is not, I think if you had to tell a story for so many years.
Yeah.
Before anybody ever even figured out how to write it down. And you're telling a story about a civilization that allowed people to put brain implants in them. And then all of a sudden the brain implants were hijacked by machines and people became just meat zombies controlled by corporations. That would be the mark of the beast. That would be a demonic thing. If a demon tricked human beings into wearing a hat that turned you into a zombie, that demon would be like a famous character in books and folklore. But that demon exists, and it's just technology. It just shows itself through this desire for the newest, latest innovations that are going to constantly fuel it becoming more and more powerful until one day it tricks you into letting it into its head like a vampire. Like the vampire stories, you had to let them in, remember?
So this is interesting. Aaron Rodgers brought up the Mark of the Beast while he and Joe were talking about religion. And in my response, I discussed how one prominent theory among scholars is that the number 666, the Mark of the Beast, may have been a veiled reference to the Emperor Nero who persecuted Christians, because in the ancient world, certain languages like Greek, Aramaic, and Hebrew also had corresponding numerical value, and if you added up the numerical value of the name Nero Caesar in Aramaic, I believe it is, it supposedly adds up to 666. And I also discuss how the Book of Revelation is probably the strangest book in the New Testament, chock full of all sorts of weird, lurid imagery and symbolism, much of which it's thought may have been referencing powers and nations and circumstances contemporary to the author, an enigmatic figure known as John of Patmos, who may have been confused with John the Apostle. And even in its time, the book was considered somewhat controversial, and there was supposedly dissent and disagreement about whether or not it should even be included in the Bible. But maybe Joe isn't saying he believes literally in the biblical mark of the beast. Maybe he's suggesting that figuratively, if everyone ended up becoming enslaved via some brain chip like Neuralink, you could view that as something reminiscent or on par with the mark of the beast. Which is strange, because I believe earlier in that Cat Williams episode, Joe actually seems to speak positively or favorably about Neuralink, but then goes on to kind of fearmonger that it or something like it, could be akin to the Mark of the Beast and result in robots or corporations enslaving mankind. And for those of you who missed the last episode, I played an old clip of Joe from about 9 years ago, where he just rails against religion, including Christianity specifically, talking about how obviously man-made it is and how we shouldn't be basing our lives on it, etc. And I might play it again later. But now he seems significantly more open to embracing biblical concepts and apparently even biblical prophecy, perhaps. If you watch or listen to the whole Cat Williams interview, it seems like Joe is taking Graham Hancock's ideas about an ancient lost civilization and is now fusing or incorporating or applying it to his view of the Bible, suggesting that the Bible might contain some of the knowledge and wisdom of that lost civilization, to the point where it might even have some predictive power. That's how I took what he was saying, at least. And for the record, I don't rule out the possibility of a lost civilization or civilizations, plural. I think there's still a lot we have to learn about human history, and archaeologists are constantly making new discoveries. But suggesting that the Bible was influenced by some hypothetical lost civilization, and therefore biblical prophecy might be true, seems like quite a leap, especially for a guy who used to, at least based on that one old clip, seem keenly aware of the man-made nature of religion and approach religious claims with due skepticism. But, and I'm not being sarcastic, I think it's a cool story Joe is weaving, and it would probably make for a good sci-fi movie. I'd watch it. Cerebral implants become all the rage and everyone starts getting taken over, kind of like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And I like the spooky touch of having to invite it in, kind of like a vampire. Joe used to work for the Sci-Fi Network, right? Give him a call. Yeah, it's funny. What was the name of that show? I forget it. Joe had a show for the Sci-Fi Channel where he would investigate paranormal phenomena like Bigfoot sightings, that type of thing. And he actually used to cite the experience of working on that show for making him more skeptical, because he realized all the stuff he was investigating, you know, at the end of the day would come up snake eyes or a goose egg, or choose your figure of speech. Yeah, I just looked it up, and it was called Joe Rogan Questions Everything, and it was on the air over a decade ago, 2013, it says. I seriously cannot believe how time flies. I remember I used to watch it on Sci-Fi, then I also, I think I found some playlists of it on YouTube, but the episodes would always get taken down, probably for copyright claims. But on the subject of AI, I'm personally not worried that AI or machines that achieve sentience might take over someday. No, you know, not really. I think it could be a possibility, and there are scientists, philosophers, public intellectuals who warn against AI for that reason, while other experts argue that it might not even be possible for machines to ever gain or develop true sentience. Personally, I don't know, but I don't lose any sleep thinking about the rise of the machines. I'm fascinated by computer science and just look forward to seeing where it goes and what kind of developments lie or lay on the horizon. I always get that mixed up. I know there's already a lot of talk about using AI to help crunch medical data, and, you know, hopefully that will lead to new treatments and medical breakthroughs. I say bring it on. What's the worst that could happen? The Earth gets covered in gray goo, or we end up batteries in the Matrix? I think I heard a scientist debunk that once and say that human beings would actually make horrible batteries. But anyway, let's get back on track. Here's Joe Rogan and Cat Williams talking about atheism.
Yeah, because what you're looking for is you need to find a mistake. That's how we would know maybe there's no creator. But we don't go through our regular life seeing things and thinking nobody created it. Like, that would be as weird as us being in this room going, nobody made those curtains, nobody made these cameras,
right.
Nobody made, like, what? We never have evidence of that.
What do you think, why do you think people have a reluctance to take in the idea of a creator? Like, what do you think about it to them is... There's some people that fancy themselves as intellectuals, and they refuse to take in a concept for which there's no proof. And that's what they'll say. They use this very reductionist view of what God is, and they'll say there's no proof, and that, you know, they're a staunch atheist. And a lot of them, they even talk like religious people. They almost their atheism becomes a religion. Instead of being completely open-minded to the possibility that you have zero idea what happens when you die.
A lot of people that are... atheists don't like God, and God would have to exist for them to not like. So
at the beginning of that clip, Cat Williams is arguing the point that you wouldn't look around at all the clearly manufactured objects we see surrounding us in everyday life and try to argue no one created them. So why would you assume no one created us or the natural world around us? That's a very loose paraphrasing. I'm more just trying to capture the gist of what he was trying to say. And I'm torn when I hear people claim that there must be a creator because we exist, or because there's something instead of nothing. It reminds me of the old watchmaker argument that if you found a watch on the beach, you'd rightfully assume that someone made it, that there must have been a watchmaker. And I'm actually somewhat sympathetic to that argument in a sense. There's logic in assuming that if something exists, it must have come from somewhere or been designed. I think the flaw in the argument is, like I said in the last episode, Evolution can't tell you where life initially came from. It can't explain abiogenesis, but it can tell you or explain how that life became so complex and diverse over time. So things can appear to have been designed, whether we're talking about trees, flowers, insects, people, the natural world in general, and yet that complexity, despite how sophisticated it seems, can nevertheless be explained by natural processes like natural selection. So evolution can explain everything, but it can offer a naturalistic explanation for the complexity we see in nature. And once again, as I said last time, that's not necessarily what I want to be true. It's not like I'm going out of my way to find naturalistic explanations because I don't want to believe in God. It just seems to be where the evidence points. I'd like to believe there's a creator and that everything was designed by some benign divine hand. It would probably be more comforting. And also, once again, I should emphasize that belief in God and belief in evolution aren't mutually exclusive. You can believe in both. There's plenty of Christians who believe in evolution. There's what's called theistic evolution, the idea that, yes, evolution is true, but that it was set in motion or guided by God. But to get back to the idea that if something exists, it's logical to assume that it must have been designed or had a creator or come from somewhere, two of the big questions that I personally wrestle with, and they'll drive you mad if you ponder them for too long or too deeply, are one, how can something come from nothing? And two, how can something exist but have no beginning? And I think those are questions that plague both science and religion, to be honest. And I know people like Lawrence Krauss have written books attempting to offer naturalistic explanations for how something could come from nothing. In Krauss's case, I think there's a kind of semantic game going on. Oh, nothing really isn't nothing. It's a bubbling brew of quantum fluctuations, something like that. Well, you know, where did that come from? And in the case of religion, well, God created everything. Well, where did God come from? He always was. He has no beginning. How the hell does that work? How can something not have a beginning? And so, you know, you either run into the problem of infinite regress. If something made something, what made that? And it's turtles all the way down. Or, you know, trying to wrap your head around how something can exist once again, but not have a beginning. I can't wrap my monkey brain around any of it. And I'm an agnostic atheist, which sounds contradictory, but it's a thing. I'm agnostic because I don't claim to know, and I'm atheistic because I've got some serious doubts. But the intensity of my doubt varies depending on which particular concept of God we're talking about. But getting back on track, again, when Joe asks Kat why he thinks it is that some people have a reluctance to take in the idea that there's a creator and characterizes such people as fancying themselves intellectuals or smart, and they complain there's no evidence or have a reductionist view of God, I have to admit, I personally found that somewhat offensive, not because of the stuff he said they think there. So I don't care if people think I'm an intellectual or not. Maybe once upon a time I did, but I reached a point in life where I don't really care. Because it, you know, at least the first part of his sentiment makes it sound like he's saying, oh, why don't people want to believe in God? And maybe I'm putting those words, you know, into his mouth or reading too much into it. But for me, I was raised Catholic and I really wanted to believe. And when I started thinking for myself more and more and started having these growing doubts about whether the God and afterlife I'd been taught to believe in actually existed, it was tough. It was very harrowing to experience that loss of God or belief. To me, there was nothing more nightmarish than the idea that there might not be a God or an afterlife, and it's something I really wrestled with, but that was the direction or conclusion my reason was taking me to, you know, or in. So to hear someone say what would make someone reluctant to take in the idea that there's a creator, it's not about reluctance, at least for me. It's about either you think it's true or you don't. And yeah, once again, he mentions they'll claim there's no evidence, and he seems to imply this is due to a reductionist view of God. By God, I mean a self-aware creator who brought everything into existence. If you want a non-reductionist view of God, you could go with the with maybe a pantheistic view of God. God is nature, or God is the universe. God as the totality of the absolute, the ground of all being. You know, some impersonal force or all-pervading oneness like you find in Eastern spirituality. But is this what most people think of, especially believers, when someone says God? It seems to me by God, people usually mean a personal creator God, a sentient higher power who possesses the omnis, omnipotence, omnipresence, omniscience, who chose to bring forth creation and has some kind of plan and perhaps even watches and judges us and decides whether we get into paradise or eternal perdition. And another thing in that comment that kind of rubbed me the wrong way, and maybe you could already tell, is when he talks about a lack of evidence, as if insufficient evidence is somehow a bad reason to doubt something's existence. And so now I'll play a little clip, as I mentioned earlier, of Joe from about 9 years ago. And in fairness, I'll add the disclaimer that, yes, I know people can change their opinions over time, but it's still interesting to take a listen to where he used to be at mentally and how he proves that he was capable of viewing things with a healthy skepticism or, you know, applying critical thinking. Whereas I think now I understand why people want to employ wishful thinking. Maybe it's because he's getting older, etc. And I understand that, too. You get older and mortality starts to become, it comes more into view. And you can kind of feel the Reaper's breath on your neck a little more. And maybe it makes you want to believe even more that they're could be something more out there or something more after this. And I can totally empathize or sympathize with that. I'm kind of in the same boat. I'm younger than Joe, but I'm not getting any younger. And just naturally, I'm one of those people that even when I was young, I wrestled with the big questions and was kind of prone to having these existential crises. But still, you know, I always try to go where the evidence or lack thereof leads instead of just trying to pacify myself with whatever I find comforting. And I didn't mean to imply that Joe Rogan no longer has the ability to employ critical thinking or somehow lost his cognitive abilities. I know it may have come across like that. I'm just referring to this one area where he used to be skeptical of religion, and now I get the feeling where he's kind of just hoping there's something more out there. And it kind of reminds me of, since I began putting this episode together, I watched a recent episode of his podcast where he interviewed, is it Ray Kurzweil or Kurzweil? I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, but he's a famous futurist who works for Google. I think he's in his mid-70s now, but still works for Google. And some of his viewers, kind of Rogan's viewers, kind of dubbed the interview as a bit of a shit show because Kurzweil wasn't the most exciting guest. He seemed to be kind of, some people were suggesting that he may have been experiencing cognitive decline because his speech was very slow paced. He brought a bunch of papers with him and was kind of slowly licking his fingers as he kind of plodded through the various pages. But there was a point when they were talking about another subject that really fascinates me, and that's longevity science. And I'm kind of skeptical of this, but there's something called longevity escape velocity. I think it's LEV for short. And the idea is that instead of just losing another year of life with each birthday or each passing year, through medical intervention, new medical therapies and breakthroughs, etc., you'll actually gain more additional time tacked onto your lifespan than you're losing each year. So lose a year, gain more than a year back. So rendering you essentially immortal, at least lifespan-wise, you could still get hit by a bus or whatever, you know? And Kurzweil, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing his name, suggests, I believe, that we'll reach longevity escape velocity by the year 2030. I myself am skeptical. I follow longevity science, and there's a lot of interesting developments and breakthroughs. There's already medications out there like rapamycin and metformin, supplements like NMN, etc., that supposedly can slow aging. In the case of NMN, supposedly it can even perhaps reverse certain aspects of aging. And that's a whole thing. I could do a whole episode on NMN and Dr. David Sinclair, who's a Harvard scientist who studies longevity and has done research involving mice where he supposedly was able to reverse aging in mice, and he promotes NMN. I could do a whole separate episode on that. I'm somewhat skeptical of all the hype surrounding NMN, but I've taken it in the past. Amazon pulled it off the shelves and I stopped taking it then, but even when I was taking it, I wasn't viewing it as some kind of miraculous fountain of youth. And there's also been breakthroughs where I already talked about David Sinclair and supposedly reversing aging in mice. And there's been studies done on animals like naked mole rats that have a robust resistance to age-related disease and live a lot longer than other rodents. I think the naked mole rat can live up to like 30 or 40 years. So I think in the relatively near future, we will see kind of rejuvenation therapies, etc. But I don't know if I can realistically see immortality on the table, you know, an essentially infinite lifespan, you know, being achieved by 2030. I'll be very happy if I'm proven wrong. But I don't know, that seems like a short amount of time to jump from, you know, us being plagued by the age-old problem of aging and dying to immortality. I'll be happy if we just make some kind of modest leap forward where we can maybe increase health and lifespan somewhat. I think one of the biggest hurdles would be brain rejuvenation. The brain actually ages differently than the rest of the body. The brain is capable of neuroplasticity, making new connections, etc. But I remember reading an article, I'm not sure if it was in some kind of medical journal or might have been like Psychology Today, about how it's been theorized that if everyone lived long enough, everyone would probably eventually get some kind of dementia or senility because the brain just wears out eventually with time. But in fairness, I think there's also been some promising research into reversing brain aging, which I think was thought impossible at one point. And I know I was surprised when I was reading about some of the Alzheimer's drugs that are either in development or awaiting approval that supposedly did things I didn't know were possible, like breaking down or eliminating the buildup of harmful proteins in the brain, etc. So who knows? And I should probably add the caveat before people get too excited that some of the research I was referring to, like the mouse studies, I guess apparently studies done on mice or other rodents don't always translate to having the same positive results in humans. I mean, I hope so, but I guess we'll see what the future brings. But the reason why I brought up, man, that was quite a digression. The reason why I brought up Ray Kurzweil or Kurzweil is because Joe and actually both Joe and Kurzweil really just let their imaginations go. And they were talking about futures where you really would be immortal. And I think you could even be some kind of weird robot eagle. It was just crazy stuff. But Joe was bringing up the concern that, what if there is a God in an afterlife? Are you kind of keeping your soul hostage here on this planet when you're meant to eventually die and ascend to another plane, you know, release your soul to whatever's next? And I'm paraphrasing, but Kurzweil didn't seem too bothered by the prospect, and he said that that's basically unlikely, meaning that kind of like a God in afterlife is unlikely. And I saw this kind of flash of sadness in Joe's face, and he was kind of like, because there's no evidence. I almost felt bad for him. Maybe I was reading too much into the moment, but that's why I brought up Kurzweil. But finally, let's listen to this little clip of Joe from 9 years ago, you know, when he was more skeptical of religion.
We've moved past Satan, but we haven't moved past God.
Exactly right.
Or the idea of God. Even the, I mean, if there is some all-knowing entity that is controlling everything and is filled with love and has a grand plan for the universe, they have yet to show themselves. So this is all just a concept and an idea with no basis in fact. And as we have found more facts about the nature of reality and the world itself, it seems more and more preposterous with every day.
Damn, Joe, taking the gloves off. Yeah, much different tone. And in the last episode where I was responding to his interview with Aaron Rodgers, at least the part where they talk about religion, I play more from that clip. But I was talking about longevity, so long, pun not intended. Definitely wasn't. Anyway, wasn't much of a pun. To get back on track, then Cat Williams in that, it seems like an eternity ago now, in that that little snippet where they're talking about atheism, trots out the old trope that atheists hate God and that's why they claim not to believe, but the twist is God has to exist in order for you to hate him, so God's actually real. And once again, you know, raised Catholic, wanted to believe the idea of there not being, did I say idea? Hopefully not. The idea of there not being a God, I'm a little sleep deprived, a God or an afterlife was deeply distressing. But that's where my reason was leading me. I will admit that I think when I was young, there was a part of me that, as nonsensical as it seems, was kind of mad at or resented God for not existing. Makes no sense logically, but it makes sense emotionally in a way. But maybe also in a sense, it may have been more resentment aimed at the particular religion, Catholicism or Christianity, which I felt betrayed by. Because I had been taught to believe in all these supernatural faith claims, a God, a heaven, only to feel the existential carpet being pulled out from under me when I start to realize it might not be true. But that was probably in my teens into my early 20s, but it passed and I developed a deep fascination and appreciation for the history of the early church and, well, I was going to say the history of religion in general, but since I was really young, I've had an interest in spirituality, ancient history, mythology, folklore, stuff like that. I don't want to sugarcoat it too much. I do find certain concepts of God more distasteful than others. I might find the Yahweh of the Old Testament a little problematic, for instance. But the idea of a benevolent, all-loving creator God in general, why would I be opposed to that? I would love for there to be such a God. It's just a matter of whether or not one is actually out there and whether there's any evidence. One of the main things that really stands in the way of my believing in any sort of all-loving creator is the problem of evil or suffering, the brutality of the natural world, the horror of the food chain, as well as all the suffering we humans, kind of removed from the natural world in a sense, have to endure. The usual Christian response being, you know, original sin, which to me is a monstrous notion that only adds insult to injury. We lowly humans are responsible for our miserable lot because two ancient people ate the wrong kind of fruit. In fairness, some Christian apologists who don't take Genesis literally, like William Lane Craig, I believe, will take a more rarefied approach, suggesting the fall in the garden narrative isn't historically or literally true, but that it's true in its essence, in a sense that we are still fallen or disconnected from God somehow. Still don't see how that reconciles or justifies all the suffering in the world. But I'm out of stuff to say, so I'm just gonna end this episode and go to bed. As always, thank you everyone for listening. You guys know the drill. You can like the Facebook page. You can follow the show on Twitter or X. Even though I'm not on there much, you can check out the YouTube channel. Maybe you're doing that now. If you'd like to help support what I do here financially, which is always greatly appreciated, for some reason there's always bills that need paying, you can go to patreon.com/theweekindoubt and help keep the show going for as little as 99 cents a month. All right, brothers and sisters, until next time.